Hello everybody and welcome to the New Art Gallery Walsall. And first of all, I'd like to thank a lot of you for your patience, because I believe some of you were on the reserve list for the original In Conversation event that that we did the other week. And very kindly, Christopher offered to come back and give another talk for us. So not only thank you to you, but also thanks to Christopher as well. Unfortunately, Stephen Snoddy, who's the director of the gallery, can't join us today for this conversation. So I've stepped in his place, and my name's Helen Jones, and I'm the exhibitions curator here at the gallery. And I worked very closely with Stephen and Christopher on the curation and the organisation of the exhibition. And what we thought we'd do over the next hour is kind of walk and move through the gallery spaces, and not only kind of will Christopher and I be talking about the show, but we're very keen for you to join the discussion as early on as possible. But what I thought we'd do is we'd start in this room here, which contains the earliest works which feature in this exhibition, which unfortunately this show isn't a retrospective, because we don't have the space to kind of offer your wide practice.
It's a survey.
Yes, it's a survey of selected bodies of work created over the last 25 years. And this in this particular room here was created during the 1980s, and is perhaps the work in which you're, until now, is the work that you were predominantly known for. And another reason for starting in this room is because of this painting here called Portrait of Elle as a Young Man, which was painted during the year 1984 to 1985. And shortly after that, once it had been acquired by the Whitworth Art Gallery, the University of Manchester, that Stephen, who was studying at Manchester University at the time, and who was writing his dissertation on Christopher, met Christopher at the Royal Academy Cafe in London. And now this conversation seems to have followed you round and haunted you throughout the course of this exhibition. But when you met at the Royal Academy to talk about the meaning, perhaps, and the content of the work, you very politely refuse not to do so. And I imagine that at that time...
It's a terrible story. You must have thought, oh, God, why have you come if you're not going to talk about it?
But I think also at that time, it must have been... well, it wasn't long since the work had been created itself, so you were probably still working out what the work meant anyway, and you're probably still doing that. Yeah. But I wondered whether you could talk a little bit about... The period or the time in which you were creating this work, which appears in this gallery, and not only what was going through your mind as a painter, but also the art world at that time and the kind of wider context that you were introducing this work into.
Well, this is actually a good way of talking about that, because when I started off as a student, I was... you may not think so today, but I was a very, very shy person. And I was horrified at the idea of having to, as it were, describe my thoughts or paint them or show people what I was thinking. So consequently, when I arrived and had an interest in sort of lyrical painting and English landscape painting and poetry and things like that, my teachers, quite a tough lot, said, you don't want to be doing that. That's not a good idea at all. You want to be doing colour field paintings. It's about surfaces and scale and size and issues. So the idea of making a painting with an image in it, like this, which is actually an imaginary portrait of my son, who'd just been born, but just a completely invented personal thing, that was a million miles away from what I thought was possible. And in a way, that helps to explain what I've been doing, because I felt very strongly that what was being suggested to me as a very young artist was a very diminished idea of what painting could be. Because I think painting can be about anything at all. And instead of saying, oh, that's literary, I'd turn it the other way around and say, how wonderful, it's got a literary side to it. So I kept thinking along those lines. Now, although it's easy to describe that, it was a heck of a battle. It was a heck of a battle. And I'm not very good at confrontation, so what I used to do, I used to paint the pictures I wanted underneath and cover them all up. So that, for some reason, that behaviour has become sort of absolutely locked in. It's become characteristic of what I do. So I'd paint my landscape and have my personal feelings. And I'd cover it up. So it looked like a big, tough painting, like a Clifford Still or a Rothko. But underneath, it had this other figurative part to it. So still a part of me is like that. So these paintings in here, they're often very, very thickly painted. And for example, well, the clearest example is Tristan, the big painting over there, which consists of layer upon layer of different thoughts and images and pictures, which finally sort of accumulate into a thing in itself, because that's the final image of the painting. So these pictures were image upon image, and Robert Hughes described the painters being mortared on, which is a bit unkind, but nevertheless, so a picture like that, which if you were to lift it off the wall, it's a very heavy object with a lot of different skins of paint. So it wasn't a straightforward process. This was me trying to think about how you could introduce imagery and thoughts and references, yet still have a tough and formally strong painting.
And you've talked about, you mentioned the imagery then, appearing in the works, and it was during this time that particularly the horse motif appeared very regularly in the works. And before that, you were perhaps producing more abstract works which featured maybe kind of banks of colour, mm-hmm. which you would place along the canvas. And you've talked about the appearance of these motifs very intuitive. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that transition maybe between the two.
Yeah, I think it's a question of looking at what painting is and thinking how you balance the components of it. Now, if you're painting every day, to the person, to the painter themselves, the activity feels very different from when you're looking out and coming to look at paintings. Now, the activity is, to put it at its basic level, it's just applying paint to surfaces. So you're sort of covering over all the time. You're putting paint on, covering over. So you've got a physical behaviour. Now, the physical behaviour, I think, has a sort of meaning in itself. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying what it is, but it seems to me to feel full of meaning. So I think I realised that the process of painting was probably saying something of some significance. So the idea of just stacking colours or mixing colour or putting it on in different ways already had a type of significance. Let's leave what it is to one side for the time being. Now, whilst you're doing that, stacking colour, covering, layering, putting skins, all the different behaviours, you paint a house or a head or a face. The question that arose for me is, how are these things balanced together? Well, they're obviously combined together. If you paint a house with very thick paint or very thin paint, that changes the meaning. But we tend to give more attention, quite reasonably, to the image. Mm-hmm. So if you pile the paint up in the shape of a horse, we immediately go psychologically to the motif of the horse and what it represents. Whereas you pile exactly the same amount of paint up in a different form, we have nothing to grip or to think about. And it seemed to me that I spent a lot of time talking to a painter, John Hoyland, who was teaching at the Slade, and John did magnificent, big, brightly coloured paintings, great slabs of red and orange and green, and I was hugely impressed by these paintings, but it seemed to me that there was an element of risk missing, that for me, the risky side of painting an image, what was personal in the picture, was missing. Mm-hmm. If you paint a shield or a horse or a landscape or a tree, you start, it just feels riskier. So, and that reminded me of the great abstract expressionists, mm-hmm. where it was very risky because they were working from their unconscious and their intuition. I've almost forgotten the question, but it's a complicated set of things. The image, the paint, mm-hmm. and so on.
And this risk and the defiance in your work to to carry on and work with this imagery. It'd be interesting to hear a little bit about kind of the art world that you were perhaps introducing these works into at the time, because I know during the 1980s you worked in Berlin for a while, and it'd be interesting to hear about that, perhaps that more kind of European sensibility or interest or favour within your work, in contrast maybe to the to what you were being taught in art school.
Well, it was extremely helpful, because I felt slightly I felt in a difficult relationship with what was going on here in the late 70s, and in fact my work was quite heavily criticised, what I was trying to do. But I had a show in 1980 at the Nigel Greenwood Gallery, which was the first time I'd shown the horse paintings, and immediately the work was picked up by Norman Rosenthal and Christos Yakimides and put in the Zeitgeist show in Berlin. And then I found myself with European painters who were much more comfortable, as it were, with their cultural background. So the painters one was showing with, like Baselitz and Penck and Kiefer, were using the sort of Germanness of their painting and finding meaning and things in it. Whereas somehow in my background, we'd been persuaded that American painting was the thing. That was the strong move. So similarly with the Italian artists like Kia and Cucchi and Clementi, again, all the background of the Italian history was somehow they were using it, and I wanted to do the same for my relationship with history here. But funnily enough, I'm still getting criticised for it. I mean, there was a review by Michael Glover in The Independent, which criticised me for references to Browning and Tennyson, which is a tiny part of my work, but it shows the same anxiety about painting connecting to literary and historic culture still exists here. Anyway, the other thing to say about Berlin is that I remember arriving in January with sort of inadequate clothes. It was absolutely freezing, and we didn't know anybody. But I had one address, which was a famous restaurant called the Paris Bar, where all the artists and painters used to go. So after about 3 weeks of misery with small children and my wife and not knowing what to do, we went to this bar, and we sat very meekly down somewhere in the corner. And I happened to mention to one of the waiters that I'd been given the name of the bar, and I mentioned the name of a painter. And immediately the boss came out and clapped his hands, and we had champagne. And he put us in the best table in the restaurant. Because painters in this place, particularly in Berlin, were people, you know, they were quite something, quite special. The film stars were in the back, but the painters were there right in the front. And I thought, yes, this feels good. And I had suspected that that was what it was like for Munch and Matisse and Picasso, you know, with a little bit of Monet, with a little bit of lace showing at the cuff. They were proper. It was properly accepted part of society. And so it was a little connection with the old Europe. So I came back with a lot more confidence about what painting could be somehow. Certainly not apologetic and not feeling at the edge, but trying to find a position somehow in the centre, connecting up with everything.
And this is perhaps a question I should ask at the end, really, but a lot of the works in this gallery are now part of public and private collections, so they haven't been shown together for a long time.
Yeah.
But having that distance and almost this reminiscing process of curating this exhibition, I wondered what your kind of how it feels really to actually see this work in one breath again.
Oh, crikey.
but maybe we can leave that one till the end.
That's a difficult one. Yeah, let's come back.
Does anybody have any questions about the work in this gallery particularly before we perhaps move around the space?
Well, I did. although I always wanted to be a painter, at one stage I got very involved with English literature, and I did at school. I did a special paper. It was all a disaster. I failed because I got so excited about literature. I read right off the syllabus and didn't answer any question on the exam sheet, and quite rightly failed. But what the point of my answer is to say I became hugely fascinated by literature. It's always made me see images. So reading poetry and the novel and all those things, I think of as what painters should do. It's what you'd expect them to know about behind their work. But I wasn't aware of any particular images then. I was brought up in Portsmouth. I used to go out in the South Downs and draw, and the drawings might have looked a little bit Paul Nash, you know, sheep on hillsides and clouds and woods and trees, things like that. But the question of how particular images came about, I find very, very curious. And the relationship with imagery is I try not to choose it. Because if I choose it, I feel I could be wrong. You see? So what I try and do is paint a lot, and in the course of it, wait for the image to come, as it were. I've been reading again the autobiography by Jung. It's called Memories, Dreams and Reflections. And it reminded me, I was reading that aged about 19 or 20, and it reminded me how, what has struck me about his thought, which is these dream images, which he's not choosing to have, seem significant, and then he works with them later psychologically. So in a way, I think painters do that, and certain images. I wouldn't have chosen to use the horse, you see. At one level, I find it a bit embarrassing and corny. But you then are then in a dilemma. You know, do I suppress it because it's embarrassing and corny? Or do you say, well, actually, no, that's the little gate. That's the gateway image, which lets me make my work. So it's those balances are awkward. But I think the only thing one can say about imagery is that I think having identified something that works, you really have to keep going with it. Rather, and even suppressing it is an act of meaning, which will pop up somewhere else. I don't know. Have I answered the question? It doesn't feel as if I have. Anyway, sorry.
You talk about oppression when you think of a horse.
Yeah.
Do you feel more freer when you're actually painting and liberated than when you're actually not painting? Then you're thinking about what you're going to paint. So once you start to think of a paintbrush, do you feel totally liberated and allow all these
No, it doesn't feel like that at all. I feel my typical work pattern in a day is if I manage to start painting by, say, 10 or 10:30, it takes me hour after hour after hour of working stuff before a little tiny thread of something might start to come. So normally, physically, it takes me about 4 or 5 hours before I start to think, because I've got too much other stuff on my mind, you know. And one feels too self-conscious. But funnily enough, I find a good way of painting is get very, very, very tired. Because when you're very tired, you're painting. But when you're full of energy and concentration and you can see everything, it's completely impossible. It's just too complicated. That's why the Venetian painters used to divide their work into a drawing stage and a tonal stage and a colour stage. It's immensely complicated. But by doing it a lot and letting one's intuition lead you, occasionally you get a little glimmer. You see a painting like that, which might have been painted for 5 or 6 months, not continually, but it was only one day I suddenly thought, that's it, got it. And then you've got conviction. But it's not liberation in the sense of, oh, I'm feeling good and here we go. Doesn't it's very rare.
This,
I have a question actually about that painting, which is called Union.
Yeah.
And what it suggests to me is like the union between light and dark, almost like the yin and the yang. I was just
Well, it's got lots of overtones, that picture, as you're picking up. And one of the overtones is I was trying to combine a painting which had a very forward surface, just sits in front of you like this big object, with something that's not there, you see? because one of the mysterious things about a painting is it's there, but it's not, is it? It's something really peculiar, which isn't there. It's a very, very odd object in the world, a painting. It's sort of metaphysical, without sounding pretentious. It's got a metaphysical side to it, hasn't it?
Yes.
Don't you think? Anyway, so the union is, yes, dark and light, and figure and depth and flatness, and yeah.
Just like oneness. Yeah.
Well, ideally, but. But there's got to be a little bit left which hasn't been resolved always.
There's another question over here.
I just wanted to ask you how much you influence the Quebec and Augustine at the time, the age, because you look to be an aim of strategy, a lot of strategies used to find an image, and also strategies in trying to force an image on, way to destroy or never work.
No, well, that's very acute of you. Absolutely, Guston was hugely important for me. What actually happened was that my tutor at the Slade was a constructivist artist called Malcolm Hughes, a really distinguished, wonderful person, and he identified that I was likely to be interested in Philip Guston. There was a series of interviews, I think you can probably still get them, by David Sylvester, where he interviewed Rauschenberg and all the great American painters. Now, Malcolm gave me a tape of Philip Guston talking to David Sylvester. So I took it home, put it on, listened, and I didn't know what they were talking about because there were no images. So I just had Philip Guston talking about painting. And the way he talked about painting, about the surface and abstraction, and what you could do, what you couldn't do, and about imagery, it was incredibly suggestive, incredibly helpful to me. And then when I saw the paintings, I realized that there were these very beautiful abstract paintings, the abstract impressionism, they were called, incredibly beautiful, fine touch, balance, structure, subtle things. And yet, Guston all the time was thinking, given modern art, how do you paint a head? How do you paint a story? How do you paint about life and keep it authentic, not illustrative? Very subtle man. And but Guston was then painting this, I don't know how many of you know his work, but he's an extremely worthwhile artist to find out about. He was painting these sort of cartoon figures, as you know, the Ku Klux Klan, sort of cartoons about his life, but painted with a beautiful, almost French style of painting. He put the paint on so beautifully that the two things seemed to contradict each other. Anyway, just to sum up, I mean, he was immensely helpful, Guston. And yet, there are aspects which were profoundly different in my personality and direction. But he certainly, for me, age 19, I suddenly got an idea of what I might be able to do.
The difficulty in getting freshness to the image.
Yeah.
Is that another reason why you move into more sculpture? Does it allow a sort of a more oblique way, a roundabout way of achieving and give and spur it?
Yeah.
You had a lot of small drawings and paintings which used to feed in so that it could lock onto something as it was working.
Well,
I wonder whether you do the same thing.
No, I think that, again, that's absolutely true. The more you know about a medium, the more you tend to get hedged around by what you're not supposed to do. And I was, in a way, brought up with the idea of what you're not supposed to do in painting. And I've spent all these years trying to find a way through it, so to get more freedom. But with sculpture, I don't know the rules. So I do lots of sculptural things, which my sculptor friends say, that's not sculpture, Christopher. they'll say, you do realise that sculpture is three-dimensional, you're just making things which just to be seen from one direction. I mean, this gives me freedom. Anthony Caro, one of the great breakthroughs with David Smith and Anthony Caro, was getting sculpture off the plinth into the space with us. Whereas my idea of sculpture is maybe think about how to get sculpture back on the plinth so it's less with us, you see. Because a painting, as I said before, it's here, but it's got this extraordinary interior, which is like one's mind. And that interests me in sculpture. Whereas Antti Kaara is trying to do that with it, like John Hoyland is. That's red, that's green, you feel it coming out at you. Kaara does the same. I'm trying to get the sculpture to go away again, give you a bit more room for feeling. So,
I wonder if we should use this actually as an opportunity to move into the next gallery here and have a look at this kind of perhaps more recent transition into sculpture room. I think what's particularly interesting about this room is that we have the painting and the bronze relief of the same title, The Sense of Sight, and we have this transition of the wing embedded in the paint and the canvas there, and suddenly this relief coming out, and then we have the climax here of the sculpture statue with shield and shadow, which a lot of people have described as more monumental in feeling. And this piece has been reconfigured to complement the gallery spaces here. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the transition, really. Well, we talked a little bit about the transition from painting to sculpture, and perhaps almost kind of the process, really, which has been carried out in this room.
Yeah, I've just remembered now, looking at this. One of the issues, this comes back to Philip Gelston, actually. The abstract expressionist method of painting was to put something down and then destroy it. And again and again and again until the image, you came to a feeling of the authenticity of what you've done. Now, the consequence of that is that you cover over images all the time. And some of the images that you cover over, when you get 20 layers back several weeks later, you may think, well, actually, that image which I covered over, I miss it. I wish, I've destroyed it. So at the time when I was only making, I don't know, 7 or 8 of those paintings in a year, or even fewer, I was burying hundreds of images. So it struck me that with sculpture, there may be a way of holding the images all in the same space. This painting, which was, I think, about 1985, 86,
mm-hmm. 86.
86. Had a lot of images underneath it. And I didn't make this sculpture until about, do you know?
This is not 99.
That's about 99. So I was trying to think of a way of keeping the images without burying them. The hard work on the concept had been done in this painting. But in a sculpture like that, the reason it's like a composite of images. So as you walk around, it's as if you're seeing a few of the layers which might have been in the painting. Hence the different languages. Because typically in a picture, it might have just a big slash of paint or something across it. But later, it might have a face or an object or a story in it, and then that might be just covered over again. So with sculpture, it's got the potential to sort of hold the different thoughts or the different stages all together. That's actually much more visible next door with the small sculptures, because very recently I've worked out another strategy, which is still to do with layers, which is instead of covering things like that, which is the process of painting, to stack them like that. So now you switch the whole thing around and you have like an underneath going up, so you stack the images that way. I mean, there are just, they're just different strategies for thinking about how to make paintings, and also come to terms with how one thinks, and to get your thinking process to feel authentic somehow, mm-hmm. and not fitted into somebody else's system.
And you've talked prolifically about the sense of touch within your
yeah.
work, both in terms of the painting and the sculpture and the prints that you make as well, which can be seen in the gallery just across here where the small sculptures are. As the room's quite small, we thought that if we took everybody in, it might be a little bit tight, so maybe you can all have a look at those afterwards once the talk has finished. But I think also the element of touch is very evident as well in this piece mm. here, titled Wing.
Yeah, I mean, touch is absolutely crucial, and I'm not comfortable. I'm not comfortable thinking. Well, what I mean to say is, I don't really trust myself to think away from the doing of it, because I think it's very. Well, to put it this way, when you're actually painting and you're in touch with the canvas, it's not just your thinking about painting conceptually, but you're physically actually doing it. So that sort of intelligence is making the piece. But when you go back and sit in your chair and look at the picture, that for me is sort of purgatory. Because when you sit in your chair and look at it, you're actually looking in a detached way, in a critical way, of what's wrong with it. It's not like having a bar of chocolate and eating it. You're mm-hmm. just you never get to eat it. You just sit and look at it. You think, there's something wrong with the bottom right-hand corner. And then you back up to the picture. And then you're in the mm-hmm. interest, the good bit of the painting. Which I think is why the palette is mm-hmm. such a fantastic thing. Now, hardly anybody uses a palette now. If you go into art schools, everybody's, well, like me, working off a table, out of tins, out of everything except a palette. Palette seems incredibly old-fashioned and anachronistic. But what it does, and occasionally use it, is it puts you right by the painting, so you can't back off. So you're painting, but you close the circle. Whereas if you put the palette down and walk back, and you're in this attitude with the picture again, you're suddenly in the, what I call the art world.
Mm-hmm.
Will anybody like this picture? Who am I? What am I doing? Why am I here? You know, when's my next exhibition? All this horrible stuff. Whereas when you're right next to the picture, you're inside mm-hmm. it. That's the pleasure bit. And the good thing for me, sorry.
That's what Philip responded, he step back.
Yeah.
He works at Quintanet. He tried to work without having thoughts between the conscious and the subconscious. And that's how you try and have some sort of freedom within yourself until you step back.
Well, yeah. That's very close to it, yeah, because. As I said before, the only point when I can get the particular release or conviction that this is what I mean to happen is when I'm sort of inside the picture. And sometimes that means, for me, getting very tired or working late at night or surprising myself or something like that. But he thought a lot about that issue.
And maybe the day paintings, which we'll have a look at a little bit later on, which is your most recent body of work, and some of which have only been created in the last 3 months, and you've applied this strategy where you'll start and finish in a day,
yeah.
almost actually kind of allows the mind and the hand to work together more spontaneously without having those thoughts interrupted.
Yeah, yeah. Although I know that because of the person I am, it's a stage, and the next stage will be. Bit different again. So.
But because of the way you work, surely these motifs and those references, the subconscious and the conscious performs, is put down quickly,
yeah.
and then you can't convert. So are you therefore surprised when you sit back? Because you can't convert from moving on.
Well, I can't what?
Because you're not covering it up. And you're
covering it up, yeah.
And you move on to the next camera.
Well, actually, what I. You'll notice the bigger pictures are in six parts. And I did that to put the layers, not like this, but like that. So it goes Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, like that. Although it gets complicated because by the time you get around to Friday or Saturday, it's above Monday. So that's too close. And in fact, one of them I rearranged to make it formally work again. This came out of printmaking. It's partly because I'm sort of starting to get exhausted by my own inhibitions. Sort of getting really tired of them. And so the idea of just working really quickly, which tends to produce more colour thinking, because form is easily conceptualised. You know, a tower means this, a horse means that. But what does orange mean? You see, you can't conceptualise it. So, and yet colour is a major part of what a painter does. Anyway, I'm sort of going in that.
Yeah, he talks about that in his dreams as well, about symbolism and colour and references.
He does, and he has. I don't know how he managed to remember. Most of my dreams are incredibly prosaic, and I justify that by thinking most of the time I'm using my imagination. So maybe I use up a lot of that in the day, so at night it's just shopping dreams or something to compensate. What's interesting with the Jungian images is that they seem to be, they tie up literary themes. So the tower is a classic Jung image. But on the other hand, it's an archetype for all of us. Because what do you do on a beach? But make sandcastles. You know, it's just what we do. It's an essential, very, very resonant image. When he was in his, I think he probably was in his 40s, had a particular crisis in his work, and he used to go back and make model villages. Well, you know about Jung, you know about this stuff. I understand that, because it's touch. So you resolve your philosophical problems by making things.
You said about your inhibitions. I'm walking around, I've seen a body of work that has less inhibition in regards to the shift between abstraction and figuration in my life.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, did you kind of have this differentiation between, okay, this is abstraction, that is figuration, and when you kind of move between the two, did you feel any kind of tension between that, or was it something that just came fairly freely?
I felt a huge amount of tension. Because a huge amount of tension, and I still do. I have an emotional feeling even talking about it. I don't know why. It's something to do. I just find it very, very fruitful and difficult, really difficult. There's something about the two languages that look antithetical, but they can't be. They must be different states of a language. I don't know. I find it extremely fruitful.
It's one of the most difficult things that I've kind of tried to get my hands around.
Yeah.
But as you say, it's when something kind of slides a place. It's almost like a synergy there, and more than one kind of one approach can reach on its own.
Well, I mean, it's absolutely true that all substantial painting is the two forms completely interpenetrate. A great Veronese is a consummate jigsaw of colour and form and tones. Absolutely no doubt about it. The two interpenetrate. It's when you move them apart that you create a very interesting psychological field with the tension between the two, and that occurs. The self-awareness of that occurs in modern art. It doesn't. I'm not aware, unless anyone can tell me, of that self-awareness of the two languages happening in previous periods. It's something to do, well, I don't know what it's to do with, but it's a fruitful awkwardness. Where I disagree with someone like Clement Greenberg, who defined painting as, I haven't got a formula for it, but it was essentially painting is a flat thing which comprises coloured surfaces. My problem with that is it's a bit like medicine. It's a cure for the problem of art. So if we could make paintings which are just flat with beautiful colour, they would by definition be beautiful paintings. But of course that's silly. any formula which speeds you to a solution isn't an adult form of art. Because an adult form of art is a very complicated thing. Absolutely not. I mean, it's the complications. In fact, if anything, one can make a good case for not working too fast, for keeping it all open. The longer you keep it open, maybe the more thoughts or resonances you collect.
I wondered if we should continue this discussion, especially this relationship between abstraction and figuration, in the room titled The Given, which perhaps has your most figurative series in to date. So maybe if we all move straight through here into the gallery at the back.
I wanted to ask when we're in here about the commissioning. It says that this was originally commissioned, the sculpture.
Yes, the top.
What the conditions were for the, you know, and what constraints it has on the artist when something is commissioned.
Well, that actually might be a very interesting question for Christopher.
I was going to, because obviously the thing was in there, so it may not be very relevant to us.
Well, maybe we could, Christopher, there was just a question here about the commissioning process, so I wondered whether we...
Yes, I was thinking of the sculpture, because it says it was commissioned, and I just wondered what the circumstances for it, when you were commissioned, how much constraints that puts on you, and... Because you seem to have a lot of freedom in the way you've changed its form and so on.
The gentleman just asked me about the commissioning process. That given what I've said about how I make my work, how do I do commissions? And the answer is, I find it extremely, extremely difficult. In fact, I had some visitors to my studio just last week, and there were a couple of ladies in fur coats, and I thought this could be good. You know, maybe I'll sell a picture or something. And somebody asked me about commissions, and I said I find them really, really difficult, and because they constrain me the way I work. And my wife happened to be there. She said, "You've just talked yourself out of work. You've spent 10 minutes talking yourself out of a job." But the serious answer is that I did a series of paintings on Wagner because somebody wanted 4 huge pictures on the Ring cycle, you know, a Siegfried and a Götterdämmerung and a Brunhilde and a Rhine, and I spent ages on it, but he was a very, very sympathetic commissioner, so he let me run with it. But occasionally I've had commissions where I struggle, and it becomes a matter of conscience, because I want to go in this direction and they want that direction. And one doesn't want to disappoint. I'm not that sort of artist. You don't want to disappoint them. So you get into a horrible muddle.
And this process of commissioning work is quite apparent, really, isn't it, at the moment? Because you're working on a major proposal at the moment for the Ebbsfleet Commission, which I'm not sure if any of you read about it in the paper recently, which is a major commission to be sited at Ebbsfleet, the gateway to a sculpture standing for the gateway for England, and 4 artists as well as yourself have been nominated for this prize, haven't they, which may consist of a sculpture which is potentially 50 metres high?
50 metres high, which is as high as the Statue of Liberty and twice as high as the Angel of the North. And you calling it the gateway to England has just made it worse.
Well, I think its other nickname is Angel of the South, I think.
I'm right in the middle of this at the moment. The problem, I mean, it's a wonderful problem to have, but because I make my work out of stuff, mm-hmm. I don't really conceptualise. So having a neat idea is not quite what I do. So I'm getting there. But it's very awkward, that. And so the notion of trying to make a sculpture which sums up England is just, I don't think that's on, really. Incredibly cheeky, even if one could achieve it. So anyway, we'll see. But I think that's about as tough as it gets. Luckily, I have to provide it by April 14th, so there will be a cut-off date.
But maybe if we just go back to this.
Now, this group of work, the reason I wanted to show these pictures was because this is a big jump. You see, you've got the work in there. I think the latest picture was about 88, 89. These pictures date from around 2000. And they, apart from this picture, they haven't really been shown in this country. They were shown in an exhibition in New York in 2004. And I wanted to show them again together because I think it was rather a crucial time in my work. What I did was to take the implications of what I was doing and try and push them a bit further. In other words, the implication of narrative in my work, which I'd explored a bit in the Wagner pictures, I thought, well, let's push that right the way through. So you get something like a complete story. So you have something, a painting like The Given, which is the one on that wall. I'm sort of seeing whether I can paint it. In a way, for me, it's the limits of my painting. Can I paint a picture like that and still hold it up as an abstract painting? Is there a point at which an abstract... I mean, it seems absurd looking at it because it doesn't look like an abstract painting, but in my mind, all my paintings are essentially abstract paintings, but they're in the form of other things, somehow. The point of the picture isn't necessary to tell a story, if that makes sense. And so, other pictures in here, I mean, things like that picture, which is probably one of the more figurative pictures I've done. And that's got quite a history to it. There was a figure in that painting, that was working over about 3 years, and finished fairly recently, I think about 2006. It's just exploring aspects of my work, pushing into this, I don't know, spatial landscape sort of area. And it's had the effect, I think, Helen, of bouncing me back into the new work.
That was going to be my next question, actually, because the painting next to it,
yeah. When
we were actually installing the exhibition, we slightly broke our rules in terms of being quite tight in terms of the time period which each gallery space would reflect. And so this painting here, Hunt, which is positioned next to the painting we were just discussing, almost actually kind of leads us back maybe towards the day painting, and perhaps shows again that almost the kind of the tightness of those forms slipping away somehow. Yeah. So for me, it almost feels a little bit like that kind of leading us back out of this particular section.
Yeah, I think that's true. I just wanted to say something more about that painting, mm-hmm. The Given, because the critical response has tended to be, and particularly I got this in New York, they just couldn't work it out at all. Didn't know what the hell I was doing. Not only that, they said actually, you can't do that. You can't do that. Now, that strikes me as an extraordinary thing to say, because since the entire premise of modern art is that it's an invention. It's an invention of the mind. And if modern art favours the freedom of the individual imagination, then consequently, you must expect any manifestation of it. And that painting isn't necessarily ironic either. It's just a possibility of painting. Mm-hmm. And for me, the test is, what's the emotional effect of the painting? And curiously, I get very strong reactions about the painting. Children love it. Children mm-hmm. love it, because it's fairy tales and stories, and they forget about painting, just look in the picture. But the what I call the art world elite, it really bothers them. It's just, whoa, that's a taboo, Christopher.
There's the comment that Anthony Gormley made as well when he came to the opening
yes.
of the
yeah,
exhibition.
That's it. Yeah, Anthony, who I've known for years, was at the Slade when I was there, he came up and he walked around, and as usual, he said, I love the new work, you know, so free. But he said, what's all this medieval stuff? I don't know this medieval stuff. So I said, well, actually, I think that's what we're like. I think that's what we're like, because we're full of memories. We're full of memories, and you don't choose your memories. You don't say, actually, I'm I'm just a space. I'm just a space, you know, in an empty room. We're absolutely not. We're full of stuff. Not only are we full of our own memories, we're full of everything we've read. And in some curious way, back to Jung, there's this collective thing going on where we all remember other stuff. So,
which is our given.
Which is partly why I called it the given, because the other reason I called it that was because if you say to someone, well, let's put it this way, the things I feel comfortable with imagining, I think are normal, right? And then one day, I think I was talking to a student, a much younger student. I was talking about something which I regard as something everybody agrees about, and they said, what? And I thought, hang on, I'm coming slightly adrift here from what's going on. But I took the positive I took out of that was, maybe the things I think are normal for me, things I thought of when I was a little boy or liked to play with, are not normal. They're very specific and very culturally specific to a particular period, in which case I'm more exotic than I thought I was. You see? So, in which case, following on from that logic, it becomes more interesting then to paint them. And so one's memories become more curious and odd. So the idea, which for me as a, you know, the child within myself is still interested in these stories, I'm rewarding the child within myself mm-hmm. every now and then. Forget the horrible art world. I'm going to do my little picture here. And when I reward myself, it comes out with this very specific, strange thing. Anthony won't have any of that.
Obviously not, he's... <yet. laughs>
Yeah. Can I just ask in the process of the image taking through the process of you?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you deal, or do you deal with the hobgoblins and stuff to come up? Because it's very like psychological thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you get that, and how do you deal with it, or is that part of where they disappear?
There's obviously a layer of self-criticism there, and of editing. It's a question of where you put it in. It's a wrestling with your conscience there. But I think that sort of weirdness doesn't actually tend to occur. I mean, I have quite a classical sense of what's appropriate for painting, I think, and I'm comfortable with that. So I don't, for example, surrealism is the thing that, in a way, we're skirting around here in this discussion. And for years I've had no particular interest in surrealism, although I was interested in de Kircher. And surrealism does produce these monstrous shapes and forms. And that doesn't interest me. I'm not interested in distortion. I'm more interested in a sort of steady, centralising set of images.
You don't think you have to risk those to get where you're going?
They're not really there. I don't think they're there. John Hoyland used to say, in bad English painting, there's always a gnome in the corner. And I don't think there are any. not yet. So... It's difficult, that, because a painting isn't a confession, it's a construction.
Yeah, I was thinking about Gustav again, it's very fragile, but also such a bite about when they such a bite, because it does say those, it accepts those kind of...
Yeah, but you see, I take the risks that I take within my circumstances are different from the risks he's taking within the New York school. And what I'm finding is the risks I take within my circumstances still have a bite.
I mean,
suggested they didn't. No, thank you for saying that. But I mean, it...
I just think it's part of the process.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. It is. Yeah.
Sorry, there's another question.
Anxiety within the work is affecting the
Well, I think he's absolutely right. There's huge anxiety in the world. That's just what it feels like for me. I feel anxious standing here talking about it, as not surprisingly. But I think it's very easy to pick up, because this isn't a retrospective as such, it's a survey of particular moments, it's fairly easy to pick up on a couple of exposed points and describe the entire work in those terms. And I think that doesn't give me the credit for having thought it through. I think I'm not saying to anybody this is a solution. I'm just giving my conception of how various the issues around painting are. So I think that's a more helpful way to look at the work, rather than to suggest this is my solution or. The review that stuck in my mind more was the one by the Birmingham Post critic, who said these paintings are fantastically and stupendously bad. So, sorry?
Right,
interesting. But what was good about the review? He then went on to engage with the issues in the show and looked up obscure references to German Symbolist painters. So, funnily enough, he got drawn into it, despite having got something off his chest at the start. So, I think it's fine.
I'm conscious of time, because we're reaching 3 o'clock, and I wondered whether collectively we should move through into the new work, and that we can have a... I know we've talked about a little bit about that already, and then you'll be around a little bit longer for a few questions. I mean, we've talked a little bit about the process in which you created the majority of the work in this gallery again, particularly the day paintings, which can be found in these, each component in these double triptychs here, and also the two paintings on this wall here were all, they're all generally completed within a day. And I wondered if there was anything else that you wanted to add, maybe, from the discussions that we'd had earlier about these works.
Well, those of you who are painters, and probably it goes for all of us, what's often not recognised when people set up with a career as an artist is it's very demanding on how much you want to ask yourself questions. It's not for everybody. Because you're spending a huge amount of time trying to work out who you are and what you're doing and why you're doing it. And I suppose up to fairly recently, I've been preoccupied with that thought, which is probably sounds grotesquely self-indulgent, but you're sitting on your own in the studio with a white canvas, and that's what happens. But at a certain point in your work, you realise instead of trying to look for yourself and work out who you are and what you're doing, you can't escape yourself. You're stuck. You're stuck with it. And actually, that's extraordinarily liberating. And these paintings, in a way, are me saying, "Okay, I'm not going to do one on top of the other. I'm not going to criticize the images. I'm just going to paint. I'm just going to paint. And at the end of the day, I'm just going to put it to one side." So. I think that was the first one. And what happens, having done that, is it's okay. It's somehow okay. it's still my painting. I'm not suggesting there aren't failures anymore. But what I'm saying is the rules have shifted a little bit. So I now feel. A little bit more inclined to keep pushing again at what I thought I was, given that I can't get away from it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So the next phase of my work, I'm really interested in. I'm particularly interested in it, and I feel something's happened. And I think one of the ways I got to this was through the sculpture and through the prints. Because I don't know how many of you make etchings or do any printmaking, but what you typically do in a workshop is you'll take in one etching plate, and you'll finish that, and that's being processed. And while they're processing it, you do another one. So at the end of the day, you may have four of these etching plates, and each one may be a different picture, because that's just what you do. You do, oh, we'll put that in for 20 minutes, and I'll try that on that. So at the end of the day, you have these four or five different things. And I thought, well, I've made 50 etchings in two series, once about 10, 15 years ago, and one recently. The 50 different images are a work. Well, maybe that's possible with painting. So instead of all the work going to one painting, maybe it's possible to make the painting like that, with everything alongside each other, like the sculptures are on top of each other, mm-hmm. or behind.
So all these skins are almost spread sideways.
So the skins are now not like this, but like this.
You mentioned earlier about actually that the act of painting is almost like covering something up.
Yeah.
And a lot of the previous works, that kind of colour goes straight to the edge of the canvas, which I think for me what is kind of quite intriguing is that the whiteness of the canvas is exposing them.
Yeah.
It's still allowing itself to come through in these, really. And that was going to be my next question of what happens next, really, after these.
I'd like to do more of these.
Well, I know you've got another set poised, haven't you, ready at home, I think.
You are right. There's something about the white of the canvas. It's, you see it in, one sees it in drawings, obviously, and you see it in watercolours, and you see it in works on paper upstairs, but it's very, very unusual to have it in the oil painting, partly because there's nothing brighter than the white of the canvas. So if you leave the white of the canvas exposed, you get a terrific kick into the flatness implied of the white canvas, and then the implied depth of the colour relationships sort of sit in an odd relationship, unless you're relaxed with it somehow, mm-hmm. and then maybe it all sits together.
And you've talked a lot about maybe the actual colours in the palette and of these works, and maybe some of the motifs as well, which you found in margins of documents that were created years ago. It almost feels a little bit, in a way, that we've completed a journey kind of full circle, maybe, throughout this show. And it is maybe a kind of a pause somehow before the next body or the next show is created.
Yes, I think that would be nice. I mean, that this thing here, I don't know what it is. But it's a very nice thing to paint. It feels. And I found this thing in a drawing which I did 25 years ago. I was looking at it only the other day. There was a perfectly decent drawing, and over here's this thing. And I thought the drawing was about this, but maybe that was also that's carrying something.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the emphasis has shifted to here. And this, it's very odd that. I think the point is just, in a way, staying open
mm-hmm.
to it. If I had to answer the question, what is it, that would stop me doing it. Similarly, these marks here, I mean, somebody said, oh, they're like nails driven mm-hmm. into the motif. But, well, maybe, but they're also like the ends of this structure. And this, which I didn't realise only looked like a dancing figure later. It's a very new motif.
Mm-hmm.
It's just what happens with painting.
And I actually found a quote from a previous article where you almost talked about the notion or the activity of painting almost like a dance as well. And I think, which was particularly pertinent for this series being so spontaneous, where there wasn't any particularly pause within the movement.
It's because you have to stretch, you see. I spend most of my time on big picture, I spend most of my time up a ladder. And if you're working with your wrist to paint and draw, I think it does something different to the brain and the body and the image. So when you're etching, the etching's that big, and it's actually quite like reading. Something with images and fingers is like reading. But when you do that, then you start to, your body balance does something which may produce colour sensation. I don't know. It's something about the intelligence in your physique. Oh, yeah, that's it. When I talked earlier about the image and paint, you tend to think of the identity of the artist as associated with the image. But it's more likely that the identity of the artist is in the touch, mm-hmm. which doesn't have an associated image. And the touch is invisible, helpfully. Because if you're doing a self-portrait, you're preoccupied with the look of the, is that like me? Who's that? What's not visible when you're doing it is the weight of the touch. But it may be, because it's invisible, it's probably more authentic than the picture. But you still need something for the touch to be on or with.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of true, and I think runs through that throughout the course of this exhibition as well. And I just wondered if anybody had any final questions, really.
No, I feel less exposed in these pictures. I don't know what it is. I can't quite describe it, but I feel the relationship between me and the images is less weighted somehow. But it's not to do with. Did you say honest? I don't think it's quite that. It's just it's a different relationship. It's like color thoughts are. It's more difficult. The association is more tricky. Whereas the portrait of Al as a young man, people say, "Oh, that's you," but it isn't me. But that's much more tricky than colour, line, mark stuff. So it's less. It's there's a bit more room to breathe.
Maybe the drawing and sketches and the objects which are on the fourth floor from your studio are actually more exposing in a way, perhaps, more than these.
I don't like all this exposing.
there's an interesting comment that your daughter made, which was almost about somebody going into your bedroom, or it's like you're seeing your bedroom wall or something. There's something quite interesting comment that she made when she came to see the opening of the show.
And yeah, maybe. But you wanted to show them.
Yeah.
Helen's idea. Let's show a wall of drawings. But I'm glad we did it because normally that just sits in the studio. And
suddenly they did feel very different as soon as we brought them here as well. But I hope you've all had a chance to see all those objects and all the sketches and drawings which can be found upstairs on the fourth floor. As well as the sketchbooks as well, which are outside the library on the mezzanine level. Does anybody else have any other questions? We can stay for another 10 minutes or so. Is that okay if anybody wants to come and ask us any questions? But I'd like to, first of all, thank Christopher for coming back and talking to you all again, and to thank you all for coming.